My guest in the studio is a leading saxophonist, composer and teacher here in Sydney. He has spent 10 years on the music scene, both in Boston and in New York, studying and performing. Sean, what was your first inspiration to start learning the saxophone?
I'd have to say it was my dad. He used to play saxophone, grew up in the Boston area. Greg and I were pretty much fed off jazz and everything pre-bebop, and Count Basie, Lester Young, Hawkins, Ben Webster, Ella, Billie Holiday. So that was kind of a background, and seeing Dad's saxophone up on the wall and things like that always kind of stoked the fire within me for a long time. And he wanted me to play clarinet and flute first, but they never really had the appeal of the saxophone. So an opportunity popped up when I was in year four, and off I went. So did a lot of begging overnight, and they relented.
Did you grow up here in Sydney?
Yeah, pretty much. We emigrated when I was about 4 and a half from the Boston area. Yeah, I went through school and then, you know, left it. Well, finished high school and went to the States straight away. So wanted to, you know, do other things. And I felt like I needed to go back to Boston. It was unfinished business for me, you know, within, you know. So I just, you know, had the opportunity to perhaps go to Berkeley. So I applied, and we found out that I got in, got an early acceptance, and then I stayed.
If you weren't a musician, what do you think you would be?
Not a musician. Well, that would be limited. No idea.
Because you've always wanted to be a musician. Is that right?
Pretty much, I guess. I've got nothing for that one. Maybe a cop.
Come in handy in New York City, do you think?
At times, yeah.
Are New York audiences more intimidating than Sydney audiences?
I don't know. I don't really perceive audiences being intimidating. I think people listen if they want to listen. Mm-hmm. It doesn't matter where they are. So, yeah, it depends on the night. You can get some jokers in there and just, like, carrying on. But most of the time, I've never really had a real problem with that. So can't really, you know, distinguish between a New York crowd and a Sydney crowd. Mm. I think the big difference might be that New Yorkers tend to listen a little bit more. But having said that, if we've played at the Sidon or Basement or Sound Lounge or wherever it is, we've had good reception, and it's been usually dead quiet whilst we've been playing. So yeah, I haven't really experienced too many bad things.
You recorded an album in New York, but you've chosen not to release it as yet. Is there any reason for that?
I'm not sure if I was ready at the time to release it. Certainly didn't have the money to. So I shopped it around when I got back. I did it in 99, just after I finished a master's degree. So I felt like, you know, I didn't get a lot of responses. It was a kind of a strange thing where I recorded it with New York musicians, and when I, you know, took it to distributors and companies over here, they didn't really go for it because it was recorded with New York musicians, and it wasn't an Australian release per se. So I found that a little confusing and a little disheartening as well, because I put a lot of effort into it, and it came out sounding good. But it was a while ago now, so we're talking 99, and I felt like, you know, as the years sort of crept on, that it maybe was just a reflection of that period in time, not where I'm at now. So if I released that instead of this, you'd have a different conception of where I am now. But you never know. I mean, I might just put that out on my own and then just sort of, you know, have it at gigs and things like that, or just sell it through the website.
This new album, which was recorded back in 2004, I would imagine you're even probably at a different place right now in music to a certain degree.
Well, yeah, a lot's happened, particularly with the cats in the band. So, you know, we've all had, you know, a lot of different experiences since then, and three of us have become dads, and Greg spent, you know, a year and a half in Japan having, you know, a great time, many different experiences. So it's, yeah, I mean, everything's got to evolve, you know. The tunes may be written down, but they're not written down in stone. And, you know, what you hear on the album was a really good representation of where, sort of the development of the band as a group, not just as four cats playing on stage. I'm really happy with it, you know, the way it turned out. It was something that I had prepared to do. I sort of wanted to do the recording and got Richie Belkner to set it up and things like that. And he did a great job, great sound, particularly for a live recording.
Sean, anything you'd like to mention about Something Missing?
Well, I wrote this just before Greg left for Japan. So in some ways it's It's a tune that kind of ties up everything that we'd been doing for, you know, that period of time. Sort of ends the whole chapter, and I knew that Greg's been a big part of my musical development, and so Something Missing just meant that he wasn't going to be around to, and it was a big deal, you know, musically for me, so...
The other members of the band, Sean, apart from yourself, of course, your brother Greg on piano, but Brett Hurst on the bass and Simon Barker on the drums. Now, how do you rate both of those amongst leading drummers and basses in the bass players in the US?
I'd rate them, absolutely. You know, particularly, you know, Brett's got fantastic sound, great lines, very inventive with what he does, but it's still, you know, straight down the line, there's no guessing about what's going on, and you feel really safe with what he's doing. Yeah, it wouldn't matter where I was. I'd be up for hiring him any day. Simon too. Simon, everyone knows Simon. Just an array of things that he can access, you know, from all over the world, and different drumming styles, and just like a little history of drums, you know, going on. But great energy. He really listens hard. But you're just never quite sure what he's going to throw at you, which is the cool thing. So having both those guys makes things really interesting.
And they were with you on that recording, but they're also going to be with you tomorrow night. How do you keep a band like that quartet, as you mentioned before, your brother spending some time in Japan, how do you keep it going over such a long period of time?
Gig to gig. We've just been, you know, playing. Well, Brett's been with us for 5 years now, so... And Simon's been with us from the inception, so it's not such a task to put these guys together. Simon said the other day, and it was quoted in an interview that I did, that's like seeing old friends again with the tunes. So and there's a couple of new ones that I've written since, particularly since my daughter has been born in the last couple of months. So it feels really good. It feels like that the tunes, everything's got a new life now. So sort of putting the band together is not an arduous task. It's like you call them up, so let's do a couple of hits, and then we do the gig. A lot of the tunes we've played over the years, but they just get a new thing every time we do it. And I think this time, particularly tomorrow night, I'm not really sure what's going to happen. We might take the, you know, what you hear on the album was what you would have, you know, obviously what you heard that night, and tomorrow night some of the tempos may be different, the approach may be a little bit different, but it'll still be that same sound. But I think there's a lot more of a deeper approach to what we're going to do.
Now, there's a lot of various brothers there have been in the jazz world performing in one bands, you know, the Breckers and the Marsalises and the Joneses. What special qualities does performing with your brother bring to an improvised music setting that wouldn't necessarily be evident from another pianist?
Wow. It's an unexplainable quality with Greg. I think just growing up with Greg, him knowing me knowing him, I would say that we can kind of second guess each other without really knowing what we're going to do. It just works out that way.
It's intuitive things going on.
Yeah, it's an innate responses. And reactions. It's something that I really missed when I was in the States. We got the band together at like from 92 to 94, and then I was away for 5 years. And then when I noticed that I had to change my way of thinking, because I knew that, you know, certain sounds that he'd play or voicings or comping styles and things like that weren't there when he wasn't there. So it's a big plus knowing that I can move wherever I need to go. And he's always there, particularly with Simon and Brett. So there's that, you know, that foundation for me is like a giant mattress. So it's like, you know, I feel confident going in any direction, and it's as a result of having the confidence in those guys.
As I mentioned, the new album Coffin Brothers Live, recorded at the Sidon Cafe. Can you tell us how you approached the performance, knowing that it was going to be recorded for a future possible album?
Yeah, I didn't. I called Richie up and I said, I want to do a recording. Can you come down and record it? As soon as we started playing, forgot that we were actually recording. You know, you see the microphones out in front and you know it's being recorded. But once you're doing the gig, that's the focus. And you lose sight of all that. And the other thing was that I didn't put any pressure or bearing on the result of the gig. So most of the time you set up, you do a recording, and, you know, particularly in a, well, you're in the studio environment, and there's that pressure to perform and to nail it. You know, I just released that pressure from everyone, and if it worked out, it worked out. And as it turned out, we got 8 pretty decent tracks. There were a couple others that were borderline, but I would say that the 8, you know, represent us pretty well. So,
having spent 10 years in New York and Boston, there must have been so many musical highlights while you were there. Can you tell us about some of these experiences?
Wow, let me think. In New York, actually just surviving and living, I had a lot of help. You know, I was lucky enough to have a really good support in that when I was living there. I would say that studying with Bob Minter was a sort of life-changing for me. Well, you know, not life-changing, but it was a big deal.
It was significant.
Yeah.
In your process.
Yeah, at that time it was. Yeah, I tried to really change the way I was doing things, and he was the right person, you know, to talk to about, you know, really anything. We could talk about composition, talk about arranging, talk about playing the clarinet or flute, or, you know, writing big band charts, which we had to do for school, and saxophone. You know, and we got to go. I got to go out to his house, and rather than having an hour lesson at school, we'd have a 2-hour lesson every now and then at his place. And so that whole environment, that whole school environment, wasn't there, and it was more personal. And that was big. You know, gigs that I saw, Chick and Kenny Garrett and Roy Haynes, and saw Brecker. You know, in the space of a week, you know, with Dejanette and Tane, Garzoni, you know, George Garzoni. Down at the Internet Cafe, and riding the subway, because I used to live out in Brooklyn. It took me about, you know, close to 2 hours to get to and from school, and you know, about an hour and a quarter to get down to the village. And so that was always cool. You never knew what was going to happen on the subway. It's just being there. It's hard to explain if you haven't been there, but it's this electricity. It's alive, and it'll eat you up if you're not careful. And I think that's what it began to do to me, and I decided to... it eventually gets you. So I decided to come back here and see what happened, you know.
I'm sure Sydney's happy to have you back. Why do you think Melbourne can sustain a 7-nights-per-week jazz venue and Sydney can't do that?
That's a very good question. I don't know. There should be something here, and it should be in town. I think if enough of the organisations... This is only my opinion, mind you. I think if enough of the organisations got together, they could combine, try and get some sponsorship, and we could have a jazz club. We need a jazz club in town. Every other city has a club in town, and it's a hairy one.
Do you think it needs a big name behind it? You know, a name like, say, James Morrison, for example, bringing in the pundits.
That would help. Yeah, for sure. We need some guns. We need some people that have a lot of clout, and because there are a lot of guys out, you know, a lot of great musicians in this town, and we've got organizations, you know, like Jazz Groove, which are doing a fantastic job, and SEMA, who do, you know, an equally fantastic job, and we need those, we need that, and we need people to help fund that as well. So, you know, cutbacks and, you know, in grants and things like that are important, you know, even if it's, you know, like $100, it's, you know, it's one person on one gig, or, you know, something like that. But yeah, definitely we need something, because we can't let this art form drop off. I don't think it's going to drop off. I think, you know, that there's a stable of, you know, up and coming youngsters and things like that. And
we got to the point a year or so back when we were, I guess, still in the phase of recovering from the poker machine era, and we're probably still really in that phase, but Dale Barlow almost said it was easier for people when they get to a certain stage in their musical career here in Sydney to go and explore elsewhere, go and further your career internationally.
Yeah, I mean, I know a lot of guys have been doing that lately, and then they've been coming back to town. I had someone say to me in New York, you don't have to live in New York to be a jazz musician, to be a thriving jazz musician. The world's a lot smaller these days. Internet, websites, you can organize things so much easier these days. So I think if you're focused and you're determined to do what you're going to do, then it almost doesn't matter where you are. It does and it doesn't. As long as you've got good people around you. That's the most important thing, I think.
The Matriarch of Marblehead. There's a story behind this one.
The Matriarch of Marblehead. Marblehead's the town that we grew up in the United States, north of Boston, right next to Salem, where we were born. And it's just about my grandmother, who was, you know, probably mid-80s at the time, and she died last year, 95. So, you know, she was, you know, deaf and almost blind, and, you know, there's lots of hits everywhere because she kept falling over, and she was a real character, and we miss her a lot. So this tune was always written about her.
Sean, thanks very much for your presence here in the studio tonight.
Thank you very much for having me, Frank.